Hey, welcome to A-Team Podcast. Glad you're here. In this conversation, we discuss autistic autonomy, burnout, hyper or hyposensitivity, disability models, and dedication to and as a creative practice. Thanks for listening.
Can you pull the door open a little more? I'm
going to
pull it now.
Tango, is it too loud for you? We need Bobby to get to Ontario. See, I think there's a difference between your gain and your headphone volume.
I'm sure there is. I just have no idea how to work any of this.
Yeah, but see, right now, I think you sound great because it looks like your graphics are showing about the same size as Tango's.
And so if I could turn down the volume on my headphones, then it would be ideal, but...
Yeah, can you?
I have no idea. There's so many options.
Do we need to have a meeting with Bobby?
So I think we actually do, but I think Bobby actually just needs to go to Ontario and just be like, hey, let's do this. You know, when people think, oh, podcasting, I've heard about it. It seems like it's so easy. Fuck you.
It's a great way to draw on an audience.
There we go. Although I do have to say, this past week, editing was one of the easiest things I'd ever done, because it was like Julie had just done a completely, even suffering from COVID, she had written a great intro. I recorded it right away. All the links were there, and the recording started at a perfect place. It was like, I don't even need to edit the ending. It was great. So the thing is, I just don't have time to listen to it.
The show notes were really useful. I learned a lot about that book that I recommended. I didn't know he had clearly just ripped off the idea from someone else. But it's still like, it was still a good idea. Even the guy who he ripped it off reviewed the book saying, it's a very good book, but you came to my course before you wrote it. So that's the thing. The thing is, though, it's a prescribed form of therapy that's just older. And like, I just think it's really good. Still, for that book. I don't get anything out of it, but.
I agree with you. I find that the show notes are actually really useful, because like, I didn't realize we'd mentioned that. That was good.
Pineapple guava. Oh my God, this is amazing.
Oh, you didn't see those before? How to grow one. Yes, exactly. No, one of my favorite things, of course, is whenever we finish and Michael goes, oh, that was shit. Oh, that was awful. And then he listens to the whole thing. It's like, no,
not every week.
No, actually, it is pretty every week. I think I've got your tape saying that.
It's more often than not.
Yeah. It really does seem like it's jumping all over the place. But then when you listen to it back, it actually like smoothly transitions and it makes sense. I'm like, oh, okay, that does make sense.
Well, I mean, mostly because I think we have to realize that when we are not talking ourselves, it's because the two other people are speaking and we're actually not paying attention because we're just waiting to jump in.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like what I think it was Tama Janowitz said, you know, basically conversation is waiting, my turn, waiting. And that's kind of maybe what we're doing too. I'm not listening. I'm just waiting.
I would like to think I'm at least a little more present than that.
Oh, no, you are. You are absolutely present.
I would have to agree.
Because I feel it. Do you feel it when you get off the podcast that like you've been, like your brain's been doing something for two? Like it doesn't just feel like I've been sitting and, you know, doing nothing.
Oh, no. And I don't feel like I've been doing nothing. And then truly, I always feel like I've learned so much from both of you that I'm like, oh, that explains a lot. I still don't know why.
Speaking of which,
I never fell into philosophy and like social systems and all that kind of stuff that you guys are really interested in. And then that's what makes me actually feel stupid, because I feel like I don't know any of these things.
There's so many things to know. There's going to be things everyone doesn't No.
Yeah, but you know, it is. It's like when you have a gap in your knowledge, you always feel like, oh, someone else knows more than
you. Have to feel like that. See, that makes me think there's a little part of you that's like looking for a gap to feel bad about. You don't need that part.
Oh my God, you've just explained Catholicism.
Oh no.
No, seriously. Yeah. No, there are always times.
Oh, you need to feel bad about something. Culture.
You're always looking for a way to put yourself down. Almost everybody I work with right now is Catholic. And so there's a whole kind of culture where I am right now where everybody's like always looking for a way to whip themselves or to apologize or
gremlin in that office. Yeah.
It's very tiring.
I can't bite my tongue around that anymore.
But one of the things too I've learned from y'all is what it means to truly be like burned out or to start to recognize that you, in the modern parlance, have run out of spoons. Because I used to pride myself on my ability to just keep soldiering through and get things done and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I've come to realize that I was only able to do that before because I was often in situations where I was the boss, where I was the person who was able to say, oh, no, we're doing it this way.
Oh, yeah.
And now that I'm actually working within a hierarchy, I find myself going like, oh, this is what everyone else is talking about. Like, no, there's no system, or you said there was a system and now you've changed it without telling anyone. And it's really, really hard. It's harder than I thought it would be.
I've thought multiple times that I don't know if I could do either of y'all's jobs. More likely Michael's than Robert's, for sure. Just because I don't think he has to talk to as many people.
Do not. And the people I do talk to are all quite nice, actually, most of them, for the majority of the thing. I did actually, dovetailing into what Robert just said, I came with questions this week, and ironically...
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Who are you?
Only because stuff happened in my head, which is how questions come about. Yeah. Anyway, yeah. But I was going to ask about sense of autonomy. It seems to be, for a lot of autistic people that I speak to, the sense of autonomy and the achievements of, like, adulting in the normal world, and especially when they were young, they had a really hard time with other people telling them. Is this a common thing? Because it came up for me a lot when I was a kid. I did not like being a kid for that reason. The world didn't make sense. You weren't allowed to ask any more questions, and you didn't get to make decisions, even when you knew the people around you were not making the right decisions. This is a big issue for my son as well. He's crazy about his autonomy. He like just is so independent and wants to make decisions. Like today he had an argument with my wife about how we're failing him because we're undereducating him. He only speaks two languages.
Oh my God.
I just fell in love with him.
but he does it in a very intense way. He gets quite upset that we're not keeping him busy enough or engaging him enough. And we're like, you are in a class, your class size is tiny. It's in a different language to the one you speak at home. Like, you're already getting A's. It doesn't, like, only so much. And he's just like, it's boring. Let's do something else. But just the idea, we were trying to explain to him why we make him learn French and why we do these things. And for him, the sense of autonomy, I think it upsets him that he's made do them rather than the actual effort of doing them. If he had chosen to do it, it would be fine. But autonomy seems to be a really big issue for himself, and it was for me as a child, and I was just wondering if that was a common trait amongst autistic people.
I mean, I can think of like a dozen different ways doctors have described us being defiant. Which I like, you know, just, yeah, prioritized autonomy, which I think is just very human.
I've been known to be contrary to people.
I know, you go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I think that's been a big critique of like this, the standardized style of education is that we like make everyone meet the same marks. And like, I guess before that, a lot of it was more tutoring and mentoring, and where someone already had strengths or interests, you would just play more into that. And that's how we used to get experts and stuff like pre-
And the apprenticeship model is very good for that. Like, I'm finding it as a way of learning is quite interesting. You're just kind of doing stuff and you're trying to figure stuff out and you're helping out where you can. Like, I find it as a much more engaging and more you're of value. And like, so that for me, every day that I'm actually able to do more and more, I feel more valuable and it helps push me along in learning. Even like in the current thing I'm doing, I'm pleased when I can actually do a task that's actually adding value to the day.
The thing that gets me about autonomy, it's funny because the moment you said it, it was like, that is that is one of my number one things. I cannot stand it when people make decisions for me. I cannot even if it's something I've never thought about before, but somebody's like, oh, you know, I it was raining, so I brought your blue jacket for you. What? How dare you? Oh, my God.
I wanted the red one.
But I realize it. I realize. I'm sorry, guys. You're gonna have to put up with this, or not. I don't know. Maybe you won't put up with it. But for the next couple of weeks, as I'm easing myself into this new job in the new building under new circumstances, I came in today, Monday, after 2 days being away the weekend, and discovered that somebody had decided to, upon themselves, rearrange the storeroom of the bakery, which I'm in charge of, and I could not get past it.
Yeah, I'd have to immediately like go for a walk or decompress or something.
Exactly. It's like okay, all my spoons just went right there. And it was compounded by the fact that I didn't know who had done it. So then it was like, who possibly thought they had some kind of standing over me to rearrange what I had already arranged? So that, and let me point out, I arranged it because I'm the only one who uses this stuff and I use it in the way that I use it. And someone else decided, oh, no, this is the way it needs to be. And it was just, oh my God, it was indescribable.
Did you solve the mystery? Because I also wonder, you know, did an unfortunate person think they were being helpful or something?
No, actually it was, do you remember the guy who was so rude when I was talking about last week, the guy was so rude. It was him.
Oh. Yeah. The guy who orders stuff.
Yeah. We're in a pissing contest because basically he's what I'm kind of figuring out is that he feels that the woman who is my assistant should have gotten the job that I have. And so his whole point then, it's interesting. Before he was
hired. I'm sorry, I didn't realize you were in high school. What are we talking about?
Unfortunately, this is just the way how many times have I been thought I was doing fine in a job and then I find out like people have gotten something against me for something that you don't fully comprehend, like someone, they think someone else, but they didn't get it. I got it. What, like, that's how life works. Like, why you think that person should have got it, but I interviewed correctly. I like met these people. Did like it's such a weird concept that like a lot of neurotypical people seem to do. They have opinions about stuff, but I'm like, but that's the way competition works. It's like being a small child who's playing a board game and you didn't win, so you're really upset. Like,
right.
No, and you compared it to a child, and in my mind, when I'm like, this is my whole pet peeve around like maturity. Like, I think we've culturally forgotten kind of like what that is or what that looks like, and so we don't know how to like, we don't have a lot of good examples of maturity or how to hold each other to it. And so, yeah, all I hear is just story after story of adults acting like children,
And it's just like, it's like, oh my God, why does life have to be so difficult? A job was posted. A job was, you know, people applied for it. I got it. Okay, fine. Let's move on. And then this is really interesting because I think I may have said the woman who is my assistant, who's been there for 12 years, came to the dining services through a special ed program. That's all I know. But I noticed something because I am very direct. I just say, hey, I hear that you've told people that you're unhappy. And she will do this thing. And I've seen other people do it. She will all of a sudden look down and look away from me. She cannot look me in the eye and she won't say anything. And it's like,
oh, she must be autistic. I hear those people can't make eye contact.
Or just embarrassed and ashamed of her.
I was kidding.
Yeah. But it's one of those things where it's like, oh, okay. So now I know something actually is going on. So then I kind of go like, oh. Yeah,
like a puppy. Like a guilty puppy.
Well, see, so here's the thing is that the ordering guy's wife has worked in dining services there for 12 years, which is as long as my assistant has been there. And I've noticed that his wife is very solicitous of my assistant. You know, like, how are you today and everything, you know, and I'm kind of like, okay, great. So I feel like they're kind of like, oh, here's somebody who got passed over and we're very solicitous of her. And I believe that they're, you know, that she's talking to them, you know, kind of like about how she feels, which makes me the bad guy. Because how can it not make me the bad guy? And so what's happening is like, oh, yeah, you ordered some stuff. You'll get your stuff when I feel like getting it to you. I won't even go into the details today, but
I'd be very careful, Robert. People who in working environments can be very cliquey and they're very, I don't know how to put it. Like it can be very, you'd be surprised how much damage they can do to you and to your career or your like ability to work there or just your enjoyment of it and taking all the pleasure out of it for you. I just hate that part of the working environment.
I appreciate it. And thank you for that advice. I really do appreciate it. But here's the great thing. I don't have a career. I'm not planning on a career. I'm doing this because it's fun. If it stops being fun.
The thing is, they could take the pleasure out of it. Not because it stops being fun, but they could ruin it for you.
And believe me, as soon as they take the pleasure out of it, I'm out of there. But here's the other thing. I'm going to win because I play to win. And it's like, okay, you know what? I've been here for 6 months. You've been here for 6 weeks. I'm going to win because I'm actually more valuable here than you are. And
my
I know
piece of advice was going to be like, is there a way to just not play this game? And yeah, then you would be complete other end.
I wish there was. But, you know, the thing is, what it comes down to is just it's like, hey, you're the person who orders the stuff that I need. And look, oh, my God, why is it everything that I'm ordering is back ordered or, oh, I forgot to do it or whatever. Great. I'm just going to order it myself from Amazon or whatever, and I'll just get paid back in receipts. I don't care. I'll get reimbursed.
I would start logging every incident.
Oh, that's a good point.
Just log every time and then never say you're logging it or never do anything. But then if it all goes to crap or someone's being rude, and like sometimes you just don't want to leave on bad terms and have a bad reputation. So if you log every event, then when it comes to HR saying something, you'd be like, okay, well, look, the way I perceive it is that this has been an ongoing deliberate, and like, you're not just saying, I feel this way or whatever. You're like, no, literally this incident, this incident, this incident. And to be honest, it could very well be, why do they think you've been passed up? Because like, maybe when you said, like, it could be a case of discrimination against someone who's openly admit they've got a disability and they don't like the way you behave and stuff. And like, they shouldn't be able to discriminate against you because you behave.
But here's what's really interesting is this guy came on and was hired after I disclosed I had a disability. I'm not sure he knows I have one.
Oh, I'm sure he does. You do not understand how much people gossip.
I was going to say.
Oh, right. If his wife knows, then he knows. Yeah, whatever. You know, it's one of those things of just like, we're only, whatever it is, 8 days into the whole thing. And it'll solve itself because it will. Because mm-hmm. I refuse to do what everybody else apparently does, which is go, oh, well, what else can you do? It's like, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to tirelessly call out bullshit. And when it's bullshit, I'm just going to kind of go like, and that's bullshit again. And that's bullshit again.
good for you. I like that philosophy. I've been known to do that.
Yeah. I was just kind of like, you know, just like, I'm sorry. That's bullshit. So we're going to go again. And then as far as the person who's working with me, it's going to be like, hey, when there's a problem, you need to come to me and talk to me about it. Hey, here's another incident where you didn't come to me and you did something on your own. And I'm going to find out how to write you up on that. Because maybe if you're not happy here, we can find another place for you where you'll be happier. How about that?
That seems reasonable. That seems fair.
It seems fair, right? Which is just like, you're clearly unhappy. So go work somewhere else. I'd rather work by myself than have somebody who's undermining me. It's that simple. And again, it's one of those things of like, oh, it's interesting, right? Because I know I'm working with somebody with an intellectual disability. And I say that as someone with an intellectual disability. But it's also very interesting because it's like, ah, right. Not all intellectual disabilities are the same.
Right.
So, you know, it's interesting because the thing that I realized I was up against all day, and the reason this came up was we were talking about kind of logical systems, is my whole day today was swimming upstream without a paddle. No, that doesn't work. I was going upstream without a paddle because I was fighting, like, there is a system and you've told me what the system is and now you are avoiding the system. And all anybody would say to me today was like, oh, well, you know. And I'd be like, no, actually, I don't. Because today it was just like, you know what? The gloves are off. And I'm just going to simply say to people, I'm sorry, that doesn't make any sense. Or I'm sorry, no. Because I just
You want to just drop the I'm sorry. Just say that doesn't work. Don't apologize. Just say that doesn't work or it's bullshit. Don't say I'm sorry.
Well, I got to the point today. I actually got to the point today, Michael, where I did just simply say that doesn't work. At one point in the middle of a conversation with somebody who was, I was having a manager, she started to say something and I just walked away and I was like, oh my God, I'm doing a Michael
Campbell. You're not meant to do that to managers.
No, but it worked just fine because it was just like, it's like, I'm sorry, you're holding me here with your stupidity and I just don't have time for this. So you know what? I'm walking away and you can come find me. And then it was like, it was interesting because later on she did come find me and acted as if nothing had happened. And I was like, oh, I made the right decision. I didn't waste any time. I just So it's interesting. I'm becoming a different person. So this could be good. I don't know. But Tango, you were going to say something and then we cut you off. And now I'll bet you forgot what you were going to say.
Oh, just that like assist, like people like make these elaborate systems. And I don't know what it's exactly like in your office, but I think about systems a lot and parts and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, system only works as well as like all of the parts doing what they're supposed to do. And then you're saying these other people who are parts of the system, they're not devoted to the system working. They're just devoted to like shuffling as long as they can keep a job or something.
Or
can't get any of these normal fucking people jobs because I can't work with these people.
it is really tough, but you're exactly right because it's like, oh, right, you're a part of the system. I even said to one of these people today when she was complaining about something about me, and I just said, look, I wish I could help you, but unfortunately, I'm not like you. I don't have the ability to make change in this organization like you do. You're the person who is a manager. You are the person who can make change. So if you want this to be different, make it different. And then I said to myself, I can't believe I just said that.
Woohoo!
That is my That's my favorite expression when speaking to a manager. If I ever have a complaint or something at any industry or whatever from the cinema and something's annoying me or whatever's happened and I want a refund or whatever, I go up and I speak to the guy at the booth. He's obviously going to say, I'm sorry, our policy is this. I'm like, okay, look, I could waste my time repeating to you again that I want to do something, but you're like 20-year-old, whatever. You don't have authority to do anything. Can I speak to your manager? They'll eventually get me the manager. Then the manager will say, this is the policy. I'm like, oh, I know. He told me he's capable of his job. But what I want you to do is manage, like your job description says, manage the situation because your policy isn't working for me as your customer. So you now manage. And my wife always says, managers get really annoyed when you tell them to manage. And apparently I say that a lot. So
if I can give you just a small example, I hope I'm not, am I boring you with these tales? Okay. So this is what happened today is I realized on Friday, an hour and a half after I was supposed to have left, that there was nobody to cover the bakery from Friday night through all of Saturday. So I found a manager who had just come on, you know, like 20 minutes prior. And I just said, you know, the person who's supposed to run everything tonight, and it's a big deal because we do this ice cream bar with hot chocolate syrup and all, you know, whatever. I said, she's never actually set foot in the bakery. She's never actually done any of these things. She doesn't know where anything is. And he looked at me and said, oh, well, you'll have to stay and tell her. Just like, I'm sorry. I just said,
lol, no.
You know how it is when you just reach your point? And I just looked at him and said, look, I've been here for 78 hours this week. And I was supposed to leave an hour and a half ago. And the problem is not anything I had to do with. I didn't schedule her. I didn't avoid or omit or avoid whatever. I didn't neglect to schedule a training session for her. She's your problem. This is your problem.
Do you do any scheduling?
I'm sorry, what?
Do you do any of the scheduling?
I don't do any scheduling, but I do manage the person who works for me, as in telling her what to do. You know, like, here's how you will spend your time. And then there was supposed to be somebody who was going to cover all day Saturday. And she was there that day, and I couldn't find her. It's like, I need to tell you what you need to do for Saturday. We couldn't make it happen. So I left a long, detailed note for her. Today, a manager came to me and said, oh, we had all kinds of problems on Saturday because you didn't leave any notes. And I said, excuse me? And then she goes on and on about, well, we didn't know what to do and we ran out of food and da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, you have to be more. And I just said, excuse me? You ran out of food? I have 300 pieces of pastry in the walk-in, in the cooler, that you didn't sell. Oh, I didn't know they were there. I said, I don't know why that is. And she said, well, I was looking for instructions. I said, all the instructions are in the cooler, which is where you would look if you were looking for food. And she said, oh, well, I didn't know that was there. I said, why didn't you call me? And she said, I didn't have your number. And then I pointed to the bulletin board where my name is in like 6-inch high letters. And I said, there's my number. You could have called me. Oh, I didn't want to disturb you. And then I said, then why are you disturbing me now?
Okay, well, at that point, inconsistency, you're lying. And you're Yeah.
I'm lying. Who's lying?
She is. Because she said, I didn't know your number, and then said, I didn't want, which means you did know my number and you made a conscious choice not to call me. So either you're insane or lying.
But this is what I thought was a typical interface between the neurotypical and autistic view of looking at things. Because she kept saying, oh, you needed to do this. And I said, but I did do this. And what she kept saying was, but that's not what I was looking for. And I said, well, you didn't talk to me about what you wanted. So this is what I did. And it seemed very logical. And she was like, yeah, but it's not what I actually wanted. And I kept trying to point out to her the stupidity of, like, there was a system and you didn't follow it. And now you're berating me for not having a system actually you're in charge of the system. And what you actually should be saying to me is, oh, you know what? I realized I should have come to you and asked you how things were supposed to work.
It sounds like she didn't take the steps to do her job.
Right. Which would have been, since no one actually came to you and explained. And at one point she said, oh, well, it's always been a certain way. I said, well, I can't do anything about that because I was not part of what it used to be. And no one has ever explained what it used to be. So it doesn't matter what it used to be unless you told me that. And she just was like, so it was just one of those things of just like, just butting heads, because she kept smiling, going like, no, you don't understand what I'm saying. And I'm like, I do. And what you're saying is stupid.
I do most of like freelance stuff right now. I left my last like office-y type job mainly for this kind of stuff. I can't do this social stuff. I don't understand why. I don't know if it's a quote unquote neurotypical thing or a human thing or what. Why do some people like need enemies or like need against-ness? Like, I worked at a animal rescue and it was like the adoption center versus the hospital people. And then most of the issues they were complaining about is because the system of the place didn't work well, because they weren't working together, because they were bitching about each other. I'm like, this place could actually be awesome. You could all be having a lot of fun. We fucking work with kittens and dogs all day. Like, come on.
Puppies, oh my God.
Like, it's so close. It was so close to being an awesome place to work. And instead it was just like, well, we have to like, you know, fill this vacuum with our drama needs.
Yeah, exactly.
And then my manager wouldn't manage. And
what I realized about the person I was talking with today was, I realized what she wanted me to say was, oh, I'm sorry. Let me figure out how to solve your problem.
She wanted you to just come in as a rescuer.
No, actually, you're the manager, which means you're supposed to solve my problem. But that's not how she saw it. That's not how she saw it. So it'll be interesting to see what happens this Saturday because, you know, because at one point she just pointed to a wall and said, well, I would have wanted a note there. That's where I would have looked for it. And I just said, but you never said that.
Okay, but once you looked and it wasn't there, did you not look somewhere else? Like,
no, and apparently she didn't. Apparently she didn't. She was like, oh.
That's what I said. That's the child's response.
I know. He didn't psychically know exactly where to place this note that I would want it. So therefore, he must have done nothing. He must have gone into a meltdown and just walked out the door or something. Like,
and the thing is, if you had gone into the fucking walk-in, where we keep food.
How did she do the rest of the day without going into the kitchen? Like, how is that a possibility? I'm in a kitchen, but I'm never going to go into the fridge. Makes life really hard.
Where there were labels, there were arrows, there were notes, because I was like, oh, the person who's going to be doing this job will have no idea where anything is. So I need to explain it all to them. This is what to use for breakfast. This is what to use for lunch. If you run out of this, you can go into this. But don't do this until dinner. Then, right? And to be told endlessly today that I did not do anything like this was just... This goes back to the autonomy thing, which was... I'm sorry. I live in a world where I know what's going on, and you're like gaslighting me into thinking that somehow I didn't actually do those things or that those things aren't important. And then the thing always was just this kind of smile like, oh, well, I didn't look there.
I see you taking a lot of responsibility. For one thing, the general responsibilities of your job, and then the extra of writing all of those notes and stuff. And then the other stories are just everyone else diverting responsibility. And I'm like, this is how shit breaks, you guys. Come on. Come on.
I'm wondering if the issue here comes from where, like you said, they would expect it to be a place because that's where it's always been. So neurotypicals hold a lot more with tradition and the way things are and the way they're used to and what they're comfortable with, not what's logical or trying to think things through. So I think there is a miscommunication where they get upset and they get annoyed at us because we're not validating their feelings about something that nobody in the same would have a feeling about, like where you should put it. There's a place, you mark it or you do something. You shouldn't have an emotional connection to it. But apparently this is a neurotypical way of being that you kind of emotionally connect to patterns that you've been doing for a long time.
Well, exactly. And it's like there's a pattern, but I'm emotionally connected to it rather than seeing the pattern.
Rather than the pattern being good or useful. It can be a terrible pattern. Like, but we've done this for so long. I'm attached to it now. I love the way we do it. Even though it's slow and inefficient.
Well, and this is a case where it's just like, I'm sorry, they're tearing the old place apart.
So you literally have had a new business open. Like, it has nothing to do with your...
There is nothing. Literally, all of the cooking utensils, all of the baking pans, everything is new. There is nothing left of the old except this mentality. And to have somebody look at you and say, that's not how we used to do it. And I'm like, look at me. I wasn't there when you used to do it. That has no... validity.
You should say to them then, you and who like used to do it that way. Was I involved in that? Like, and have you then informed everyone who isn't part of your little clique that used to do it that way how you would like it to be done, and then we can inform you how to do it properly.
But see, the thing with all of this, and I'm sorry, Tango, we cut you off again, but the thing with all of this, I just want to scream. I want to stand up on a chair in the middle of the whole place and just go, can no one send a fucking email? Oh my God, just send an email and say, hey, everybody, here's what's going on. Instead, everybody is like, what's happening? And the thing is,
that sounds like a management job.
Oh, yeah.
Sending emails. Well, easier if you just defer off to other people and blame them for stuff not happening.
Exactly.
Rather than do preemptive planning or work.
I'm realizing now why I was a bit of a prized stage manager for my time.
Oh, yeah.
Because in a way, I felt like, there were lots of things I was responsible for, but I also just got to kind of like be my own busy bee between people. And I really only, you know, whatever the director said. But yeah, I just held all of the joints in, why have I suddenly lost everything I was going to say? Just basically, I would be the person to send the email just to like make sure the communication or make sure this person's updated on that thing.
You took responsibility. You took responsibility.
So that the prop guy can do his thing and the lighting guy can do his thing. But then I can make sure the whole thing is running because that's the stage manager's job.
Weird. Managing in a managerial position. That's a new approach.
I honestly actually never thought about that being like manager experience that I've had, but that
it's absolutely manager experience. No,
making sure everyone knows what's happening and what is going to happen and that they're in the right place at the right time and that there's not overlapping of schedule or parts where there's no one scheduled or
that everybody has what they need to succeed.
And then stepping in to fill in gaps and also,
but only gaps that can't be avoided, not gaps that are the result of
your poor planning. And then when you do that, you ask nicely, is anyone willing to help me out here and fill in this gap? I know it's short notice, but I would appreciate it. And then when they're done, you go, oh, remember last Friday when you filled in for me? That really helped out. Thank you. Boom. Done. Management.
The best thing is to be straightforward of like, okay, guys, this actually, there's nobody here to fill this role. We've all come together to do this thing. The more just like honest and straightforward instead of like pussyfooting around or, you know, trying to bribe someone, we had some difficulty
with the scheduling. There was a mistake made where there's a gap here that for 3 hours. I'm hoping one of the guys who can either is on the shift can stay 3 hours, would volunteer to do that, or the one coming in before. Are either of you free or could reschedule your own personal lives to help me out? It's really weird that we treat people like adults and humans, and we wonder why we've all lost the ability to be adults, because no one's responsible for anything. There's no one in charge. Everyone's just pushing bits and pieces around and...
I love when, like what you're saying, Tango, when you finally like, oh my God, there's a void and I need to step into it. So I may have told you that we're having this problem with one of our big mixers. It mixes 20 quarts at a time. It's huge. And the most important thing about it is that my assistant feels very, very comfortable using it. And the fact that it's not working right now for whatever reason means I don't have somebody who feels comfortable. So I'm not actually able to produce what I need to produce. And this has been going on for 3 weeks now, because it was a problem 3 weeks ago. And the person on the dining hall side, it ended up was like, okay, we've tried out everything else. Now it's you and you need to call the company and you need to get someone out to fix it. So Wednesday last week, I said, so what's happening? Because I've been waiting a week. And he said, oh, I called them Monday and left a message. And I was like, really? Okay, so Friday, I called the company and I actually got somebody on the line and actually waited till I got somebody on the line. And he was like, oh, you know, we're all backed up with tech, you know, with service. I said, that's not acceptable. I finally, you know, I got him to agree to send somebody out ahead of, you know, we jumped the line. That's fine. I have that ability. Okay, great. My favorite thing was today, another manager came to me and said, oh, good news. The repair guy's coming out to fix the mixer. It's like, really?
Who told you that?
How did that happen?
Yes, but obviously the manager took responsibility or like said,
apparently, oh. But it's just one of those things of like, oh my God.
Someone asked him later on again, what's going on with that? And he went, oh, don't worry, I have it sorted. There's a guy coming out. He didn't say, I screwed up, didn't do anything. Robert called. No, no one says that. Be realistic. I would never say that. If someone above me asked me, I'd be like, yeah, okay. No, yeah, it's all under control. Don't worry about it.
But it just was one of those things, though, of just like, oh my God. Because it was also like, it didn't take that much to get the guy on the phone.
See, the weird thing about that is I would have maybe gone for the other solution of actually taking it apart and trying to repair it myself.
Well, actually, that had already happened.
Oh, someone, okay.
Yeah, we're that's why I'm saying we're far beyond, and that's why we need the guy, right? But it's just...
And it's often after I try to repair things that we need the guy.
it just wasn't that thing of like when you have your life narrated back to you. I guess, it goes to the thing you were talking about in the beginning about autonomy, which is like, oh my God, do you think I don't know this? I'm the one who made the call. And now you're talking to me like I don't know this. Again, it's like gaslighting all over again. It's like you are negating not just my experience, my life. Because when did I call the guy? When I was driving into Philadelphia at 3:30 to the gym, and I realized, oh, I could call Hobart right now and I could get them to come out and whatever like that. And so that's when I did it. And so just as that thing of just like, I realize this may not have been on everybody, you know, the highest thing on anybody else's, you know, thing. And that's why I did it, because it's very high on mine. And I immediately, like you, Tango, as a stage manager, sent out an email to the concerned parties to say, hey, this is where we are right now. Did I get a reply? No. And I don't mean thanks, just kind of like, great, we could chase it, you know, great, we could cross it off our list, or like, oh, do they also know? But I heard nothing. So then to hear that the only response to it was, hey,
someone
good news.
Telling you the thing that you did. Oh, yeah. So, yeah. For some of the autonomy stuff, I've been thinking about it on the back burner. I'm like, well, it's natural that you're going to like bump up against things or people do incompatible things. But yeah, I think the issue is when it really falls out of balance and when you feel like you're bumping up against way more things than you're choosing.
Is it also partially why a lot of people find long-term employment very difficult? Because time management, they want to do things when they want to do them. Like, it's why a lot of autistic people seem to work in freelance or contract jobs, because they do what they want to do at the time they want to do it. Just because you have office hours between 9 and 5 does not mean my body is complying and I feel like energized and working between 9 and 5. My brain decided 2 in the morning was when I should do this. And then there's like, well, you weren't in work yesterday. Well, but I did do 9 hours of work during the night. And they're like, well, you can't do that. And you're like, well, why not? I got more productive work and better work done. And then I slept during the day. And it's that level of control over you that you're like, but I can't fully control my body, so I'm going to work within what we have to get the best result I can. But you're just throwing in extra rules that make it more awkward and that also infantilize me and say, you have to be here between this time and this time because that's what I'm paying you for. It's not what your abilities are. It's literally we're just buying your time. You are of no value. It's just the time that we're buying. But like, no, there's a skill set. There's my focus, my ability to do things that are also of value. So I find it degrading and it can be, I don't know, the whole idea that companies are starting to move people back into the office, even though they could successfully work from home, is mind-blowing to me, because I would be so insulted if my employer did that. If my productivity personally hadn't fallen, or maybe if they said your department's productivity fell by 40%, I'd be like, you should fire everyone who fell by 40%. That's not my problem. Why am I being punished? I'm a good worker. I didn't fall by. Can you let me work from home and be a perk for being good at my job is that I get to do it when I want to do it. But no, you want to micromanage and control things.
I like the words you use, like infantilizing and...
Do most of you not think that that is one of the worst parts of being autistic, that people can often treat you like you're... ideas are invalid? Like it's that kind of thing where they kind of talk down to you and they're like, and I'm like, oh my God, you're as dumb as a post and my opinions are much smarter and clearer and concise than you, and you're talking to me like I'm a child.
When it turns out, a lot of times they just didn't understand.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you were actually like wittier or smarter than them in that moment.
Yes.
And it was different from what they're used to and they didn't get it. So they just assume that you're wrong. Like the arrogance goes that deep.
Yeah. Or as you're explaining something and you realize they don't understand because you're actually onto step 7 and they're still wrapping their minds around step 2. This is coming up a lot in the situation I'm in right now because we're in this new building where a lot of things have never been done before. And so like there was a group that came to me in the bakery the other day because there's supposed to be this display case. that apparently will never be built. And then they were like, well, what do you think about this? They actually, you know, there were like seven people there, two architects, the guy in charge, it doesn't matter, all these people. And they're like, and I had never seen this thing. And they finally showed me, you know, the artistic sketch of what it was. And they said, see, there are like two shelves. And then there are three shelves where you could like put decorative stuff. And I just said, no, I hate it. And they went, why? I said, I don't have time for decorative stuff. I can't dust decorative stuff. I barely have time to do what I'm doing. And then everything I do will have to be in this thing that doesn't actually serve the public very well. And they kind of went, well, wait, I don't understand. I mean, because I said something about I have to put, I sell 500 pieces a day. Well, you could put 200 pieces in this and then you could put 300 pieces over there. I said, that's not the point. They're like, but I don't understand. You just said it was about 500. It was like, I'm just giving you a small example, but there's so many.
You made really good logical examples there. And then if someone was like, oh, but if they replied, I would feel so unheard. Like I just gave you really good reasoning and I explained what I'm thinking about. And then you basically didn't hear me and like continued to pitch a product I don't need at me.
And now you asked the person, you asked my opinion and then you ignore it. And I'm the only one here of all of us with the actual experience of what this whole thing is. You know, but the whole idea of like, what am I supposed to put on three shelves for an ever changing, for an ever changing landscape? It's like, I don't have fucking time for that. You know,
also, aren't your customers like college students?
Yeah, they grab the food and they run.
It's not like a bougie cafe.
I'm putting up a Christmas elf. You know, it's like how often, it's like, I don't even want to get into how often is the display supposed to change. Just no. And they were kind of, but the architects looked at me because they had designed this. They were like, but really, don't you want this? Like, well, among other things, not only is it impractical, well, it's impractical, but at least it's ugly. You know, it's just like, and they were like, oh, it's like, I just... that whole thing of being infantilized, like you said, Michael, just comes up all the time because you're like, because I realize also one of the things I think we are very good at or perhaps poor at being autistic is we never explain how we get to 0.7. We don't explain points 1 through 6. We just jump to 7 because duh, you know,
QED. I like that. When I'm I like that when I'm having conversations with other autistic people, I'll jump in and go, this is what I was thinking. And they'll kind of go, okay, so we came from here. And they'll catch up with you almost instantly just from you saying it. Whereas a lot of time when you're talking to non-autistic people, you have to give them a pathway from where they are to where you could possibly be. Whereas other autistic people seem to be able to just go, okay, so he's here. So we were here. Then, okay, this would be the fill. Because now, like, it's like the theory of relativity is amazing for someone to come up with, but it's not actually as crazy to learn because someone else already came up with the concept and you're now just proving it or reaffirming it. Like, whereas I don't think, like, I'm smart enough to understand the theory of relativity. I'm not smart enough to be the person who comes up with the theory of relativity. And like, that's things. So like, you come up with something and you're like, okay. And I find that autistic people are better at making that leaps along the way to where you are. When you say at the other end, this is the way it is, I'll often get arguments going, well, no, because of this. Because I'm like, oh, obviously I considered that. That's really obvious. And it's not the case because of this and this. I'm like, are we even going to go through all these silly little steps that get you there?
And the thing is, when they say that, you realize, oh, you want me to pat you on the head for stating what anybody would have, anybody who applied 3 minutes of time to this would have come up with that solution. And I'm supposed to go, oh, good for you. You saw the obvious.
I'm sort of like extra sensitive to condescension because of lots of things. You know, you might share that. And so, yeah, sometimes when I say something and someone comes back and if I'm like, doesn't that seem odd? I would have obviously already thought of that. You must think I'm an idiot. Fuck you. And really, I'm overly sensitive like 80% of the time, and maybe 20% it's an actual thing happening. But could be. I'm getting better at noticing it. or at least just not having a big response. I can at least more calmly now be like, okay, that's not a personal thing. I can be like, no, I already thought about that, you know, and I don't have to like fully receive it as this person thinks you're a fool. You know, we're all arrogant a little bit.
And then the thing that always gets me about
it's not like, a little bit,
truly, truly great leaps of intuition and imagination bear often no resemblance to the starting point. That's what makes them so incredible, right?
Yeah.
So when you come up with one of those things where it's like, I don't know how you got there, and everybody's like, prove your work.
Clowns and seals.
Like, I don't know how he got there. I'm sorry?
Clowns and seals.
Yes, I said clowns and seals. I say clowns and seals. And I'm just going to do that from now on because there are just so many times where it's just like, oh my God, why does it matter? And so like stuff that's happening right now at work where it's just like, you know, somebody like the cake mix comes back to sit on my shelves where I've already said I don't have room for it. And somebody goes, well, like, well, you had room on. There was empty shelves. It's like, yes. And in the next 5 days, we're expecting so much backordered equipment that there is no room for it. And now there's even less room because you've taken it all up with cake mix that I will never use. And but you can see him going like, but you had empty shelves and cake mix. Well, that's a bakery.
And
so
that
why
goes
shouldn't
on
that go to you? What?
It goes on shelves. It must go on shelves.
And it has flour in it. So it should go in the bakery. And you're like, oh my God. I'm just gonna find a good balloon whisk and beat you to death with it.
Seems fair. I did have one other question when I said I came.
I love that I'm watching you with a pad of paper and a pen, and you're like a reporter. One more thing, Mr. President.
I'm more like Columbo, thank you very much.
Oh, okay.
Just one more thing. Just one more thing. The other one I was going to ask about, do you all go, or is this just an ADHD kind of thing I think I might have, about, like, you get an idea, and it's really good, but if you don't get started on it, it breaks down and you lose interest in it if you don't get going. Like, if you have an idea for a project and you can't get it organized or you don't have time, a month later is it just not interesting to you, even though it's still a great idea, nothing's changed, but it kind of breaks down of interest. You lose the momentum and you lose the interest.
The sexiness is no longer there.
Yes. Like, right. Even my son was really into playing like D&D or something, right? And his grandfather said to him, oh, I will, do you want to make a leather, like a costume out of, his dad does a lot of handcrafts and woodwork and stuff. And he was like, well, you could make you like armor, like knight's armor out of a costume thing for it. And Felix was like, super, super excited. But then he didn't get to see his grandpa for a couple more weeks. His grandpa had to go and do a few things and blah, blah, blah. And then his grandpa finally got the piece of equipment he needed for it and did this and this and this. And he was like, so are you ready? And my son was like, no, not interested anymore.
Oh,
I just blatantly said to him, like, no, I'm not interested anymore, and just walked off. And I was like, oh, yeah, I feel sorry, because that's like a blow to a grandparent. But like, I'm like, that's just Felix. He lost interest. Sorry. He doesn't know to be kind about it. He's not meaning to be rude. He's just like, no, I've lost interest.
He's just being honest. Yeah.
Yeah. He's just there. But I noticed that, see, a lot of the things that I think about, I see him do something. I'm like, oh, I'm so like that. I do that. Maybe that's not just a me thing. Maybe that's a more of a larger autistic thing. And I'm just wondering if that, like, the losing interest if you don't get started is a thing.
I think I know exactly what you're talking about. And it's funny, I can't point to an example of myself right now, but I can tell you about the person I'm working with who I had said today, oh, I need you to make up 3 batches of brownies from Mix because whatever. Okay. And literally the stuff is you dump it in a bowl, you add water, you mix it up, you put it in the oven. It takes all of 45 seconds. It's one of the most disheartening things I've ever seen. So, and we'd already had a talk the other day about, hey, you know, in baking, you need to mix up whatever it is you're doing and put it in the oven as quickly as possible, because otherwise all of the carbon dioxide that provides leavening will escape. So I'd said something like, you know, go make these brownies. And she's like, oh, yeah. And then I look over and she's mixing the batter. And I'm like, wait a minute. And I said, do you have a pan prepared to put that in? And she goes, no. And what I realized was she was so excited about the idea of making the thing that the actual logical process of this is how it has to work. And that, I don't know why, Michael, but it kind of strikes me as what you're talking about, which is the, she didn't want to lose interest in what she was excited about, which was making the stuff. What she wanted to be able to do was do it right then and there. And that was important. And that, so that's the thing that kind of gets me thinking about what you're saying, which is, yeah, there have been plenty of times where it's like, oh no, I need to do it. Oh no, I need to make room to do it. I need to clear off the bench. I need to whatever. But no. I'm going to do it now, which is why, you know, you start a project in the middle of God only knows what, because that's the sexy part.
I'm just wondering, but for me, it's even that thing I was talking about where a little while ago I had an interest in kiteboarding.
Mm-hmm. And I was it's gone already.
No, it's not gone, but I was kind of delighted it was coming into winter and was totally unfeasible, because there's a good chance by the time it comes around next winter or next summer or spring or whatever it is, I'll just have lost interest. And it, like, sometimes I don't, sometimes it'll hit me again another time. I think it has hit me before a while back and I didn't get to do it, and then it went away and it'll come back. And I'm just wondering if that's an ADHD thing, a sort of a focus thing, and if I can't fulfill that need, that like the endorphin drop of being involved in it immediately, it just doesn't build, it doesn't get going. Maybe it's just a me thing.
I just know there is a certain kind of, I don't know what we call it, like fever pitch that something has to be at. And then if it doesn't sustain, I'm done.
Yeah.
Do you have any other examples?
Me. Yeah. There usually, the thing is, they're kind of non-examples, because most of the examples are, I'm like slightly interested in something, it's building, I'm thinking, oh, this could be a big interest. And then just something gets in the way of being involved in it, like whatever it is, it doesn't really matter. And then if it's just delayed by even 3 weeks, even though nothing else happened, it's like I used up too much energy without getting any additional information or any additional interest. So it just died off.
You repeated the model, but you did not provide another example.
Absolutely, I did not. Because as I said, there are lots of non-examples, because they're things that didn't happen. And it's very hard to prove a negative.
If not impossible. Yeah, I know what you're talking about, which is it was really, really, like the number of times I've embarked on a project, like, oh, I'm going to do this. And I get the supplies and stuff. I think you've talked about this. And then like a week later, I look at it. It's like, why did I ever think that was going to happen? Who cares? You know, like I invested not heavily, but I did invest in a certain amount of equipment for tying wigs, you know, hand tying hair into wigs. He's like, yeah, I'm going to make this happen. This will be good. And so I do have the equipment, but have I tied a single knot? Nah. Because there was the point where it was like, it's almost like bipolar. You know, it's like I was on a manic phase, and so I bought this stuff. And then that ended, and it was like, no, I'm not doing this. And then because I haven't done it for a certain amount of time, there's no way I'll ever get into it now, because it'll be like admitting defeat.
Okay, so this is the way you called it, like a bipolar. It is almost for me like that. It's a sudden interest, the urge to do it. And if it just doesn't get going, it just, the manicness falls out of it. And like, it's like, I just can't be bothered. I would describe it as starting a fire with some twigs and they're burning and it's beginning to get going, but you need to put some logs on that fire for it to be sustained. And if you don't get those logs on fire, the kindling just flares up and then burns out.
Yes.
And I was wondering if that was just, is that a trait of autism, or is it more of a commonly, and I was going to use you as a sample group, all two of you, completely legitimate sample size.
I mean, it definitely sounds neurodivergent. I don't know if I would just, I don't know if it's like an autism specific thing. Mm-hmm.
So it's not something you have as a, it's not something you're aware of yourself doing?
I mean, kind of, it's a vague, you've given me a vague model with not a lot of examples, and I'm at like the low point of my hormone cycle where I don't have like my full brain access. If you can't tell, I'm a little tired. I might be more monotone than usual or something, I'm not sure. Hi, I'm Tango, I'm autistic. I'm like, I have a lot of interests, and I do have to pay attention to like how much I just want to do the fun thing, and then how much structure it's going to take, how much money it's going to take, how much time it's going to take. Are other people going to benefit? Like, I run through a whole thing and then figure out if I can fit that new desire or hobby in or not. Is that an answer?
It actually very well is, because maybe that's what I'm talking about. If it doesn't dynamically fit into the things like... So, like, even at the moment, I'm trying to write a book. And mm-hmm. I had a period of time off, and I got, like, a chunk of it done. Like, I got maybe 10,000 words of it done. I have a good idea. I still run ideas over in my head, but I have not had time to sit down and write in a couple of weeks, and part of me is losing interest, but the story in my brain is still so interesting, it's still staying in my field of interest, but I actually just don't seem to have the time to spare to do so, because for me I can't just sit down for 20 minutes and write. I have to kind of work, like, and start rethinking and set my brain into a flow type pattern, and it takes a bit of time, and I have to have a bit of free thought, like, and free association stuff going on before I can start to write or come up with new ideas.
Well, is that in some way related to the endorphins that happen? So, like, when you have the idea of doing the project, the new thing, it seems really exciting, so you're getting the rush of endorphins associated with, like, ooh, potential, whatever. And if you can get right into the project right after that, then it's like that all keeps up. Mm-hmm. But then when it's like, oh no, they've died off and there's no hope of, you know, going to have to work to get them again. It's the immediate gratification, I think, is what it's really all about. Because the number of things where it's like, oh, I have to prepare for that. Oh, then I don't want to do it.
See, and that is something I associate with autism. The endorphin drop for curiosity and the new and discovery, it seems to me the way my brain is more wired towards that rather than crossing. Like, some people are very good naturally and have abilities to be very detail orientated and spend the time crossing the T's and dotting the I's and doing all the really important detailed work. Whereas I'm much more of an ideas person. Follow through is more difficult. Exactly. Like, it's good enough. I believe completely in the 80-20% rule for every project.
No, 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 no.
What's that rule?
Everyone loves that. It's such a good, solid work ethic. Robert, you can explain. You probably know more about management than...
Well, you explain. I know what the rule is, but I don't want to have
I believe that about 80% of all the work is done with about 20% of the effort. And to get the last 20% done takes about 80% of the effort.
Oh, I think some people are like that and some people aren't.
Okay. So for me, I associate heavily with like the autistic way of being. That sort of like the interest, the ideas, the endorphin drops for working on new and gratifying things. And it pulls our attention completely. And then when it comes back to doing the boring parts of like the detail oriented, it just doesn't quite meet what my brain likes to fire on.
I think part of the reason my tired brain is struggling is because I tend to not use the like dopamine endorphin language or models as much. And I not that they're incorrect. I just look at a different layer, and mm-hmm. I've been more focused on the emotional layers in the last couple of years. Cause even something Robert said earlier, where like, if you leave a thing and then you come back and you feel bad about it, or you feel like you'll notice these like weird emotional barriers that are actually kind of pushing you through a maze of choices you didn't realize mm-hmm. is why the shape of your habits might be that shape. Because you keep, not you personally, we just find ourselves in these cycles. Yeah. Of like, oh, well, because I didn't do it for a few weeks, when I go back, I like, it has to be this way. Like you were saying, you like need certain things to get into flow, and maybe that's true. But also when I get there, I'll be like, is that true? Like, would it not be, could I build a little bit of momentum if I just gave myself like 20 minutes, and then maybe doing 20 minutes for like 3 or 4 days, then I'm just like excited to make room in my schedule to sit down for an hour and write. Like I don't know if that's hacking, or I do little things like that with myself of like, not only, okay, this is the ride I go on, but then stepping outside of it and being like, okay, why do I do that ride in particular? And can I like change the tracks? And I've amazed myself over the years of like how much we can change. People are like, oh, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, but and maybe I'm not old enough yet, but like, I don't think I believe that.
Well, you guys have said a couple of things. You were talking about crossing the I's and dotting the T's, Michael. And I realized that when I'm really involved in a project, I am only crossing T's and dotting I's. For me, that is flow. And I will do it really, really well. And what this conversation is making me think of is when a project happens to hit in whatever way, that the initial thrill of it is supported beyond, and I don't know what supports it, but there's something that can support it beyond the initial thrill so that you can keep working at it, then I'm all there. But if it's like, oh, there's the initial thrill, but like you said about your son, and now there's a 3-week pause while we get parts or do something else, it's like, it's not even that I've lost interest in that particular thing. It's that it's been supplanted by something else. Mm. And because it's been supplanted by something else, what did I ever see in that? That's just not, well, just not.
For me, that's when I have to come in with discipline and be like, okay, motivation has been lost. Do we really need to do this thing? Do we really want to do this thing? And I have to like double check. And if that's still a yes, then I like build myself a little mini motivation ramp plan.
So I'm just going to go back to that. I want to start trying to adapt your point of view, because I don't seem to have come to a solution for myself when I lose interest. So you were saying there, and what I'm thinking I might want to start doing is looking for emotional barriers that are actually stopping me push forward, and not actually rationally the things that I think are kind of like, oh, the delay in this, but because the coming back to it's where it's really difficult, because it might be a 3-week delay till you can get a part, but then when the part arrives, I just can't generate the interest again. So it might be an emotional barrier for me. Do you have any tactics in relation to how to put the planks across the bridge so that there's not big gaps in them?
Basically just rebuilding with bite-sized pieces or steps, and then just checking in with how they go. So if I haven't written for a couple weeks on my book and I give myself 20 minutes and I do it, I might be like, wow, I got into flow easier than I thought. Or I might be like, I spent the first 10 minutes just thinking about how I felt bad for not writing for the last 2 weeks. I need to work on, there's actually like a guilt thing here I need to unwind. And that's what's getting in my way. It's not the right, you know, does that make sense?
Absolutely. Can you become my...
Yeah, just bite-sized pieces, and then you got to meta, like, look at them after you do them. Like, okay, what happened?
And what I would add
Can
to
you
that...
become my psychiatrist?
Are you going to pay me? I don't have licensing for that.
All right, it's
I don't want to get into this kind of coaching, though, with people. But yeah.
I want to talk about you coaching, but I want to add one thing to what you just said, which is... So there's a big thing going around right now amongst people who go to the gym of pointing out the difference between motivation and dedication. And I go to the gym regularly and people go, oh, wow, I really admire
you. Sorry. That's joking.
But you clearly don't lift, bro.
Thank you. Thank you very much. You can only see my head floating in the darkness. Anyway, what a lot of people who go to the gym and people go, oh my God, I really wish I could do that. I really wish I had your motivation. Mm. And there's been an increasing kind of realization amongst a lot of people. It's like motivation has nothing to do with it. If you're waiting for motivation, you'll never go anywhere.
Agree.
It's dedication. It's dedication that says, even if I'm not motivated, I still drag my ass out of bed and I get there and I do the thing because I'm dedicated and motivation is never part of it.
Because you could point out to the person looking at you, you have plenty of motivation to go to the gym. What you're lacking is the actual dedication to go to the gym.
Exactly. Right. That's exactly right.
Because usually the person who's saying, I wish I had it, is actually someone who has plenty of motivation.
Plenty of motivation.
There's many reasons you should be going to the gym.
And they're just not dedicated. So like when you're talking about a writing project, and because I actually have a degree in writing, not that it's done me any good, but because writing was a big part of my life for a long time, the thing that's important about writing is not motivation. And that's what I hear you saying is, oh, mm-hmm. I'm not motivated to write. It has nothing to do with it. You've got to be dedicated. And the way to do that is you simply say, you can take the J.K. Rowling approach, which is from 5:30 a.m. to 6:30 a.m. when I know my kid is asleep in the pram or whatever it is, for 20 minutes on the train, that is my writing time. And it is not something that is negotiable.
There's less hate in that than I thought there'd be.
Say what?
Sorry, less hate in that than I thought J.K. Rowling. I thought we'd be going into racism or something.
No, I'm not going there. But the thing is, she was very, very dedicated. That's how Harry Potter got written. And Tango's point is especially important, which is when you say from whatever it is, from 4:40 to 5:05, because that's literally the time I have, I am writing. Now, what I call writing may be, like Tango just said, examining why I haven't written. That is part of the process. It's not just, oh, I didn't put something on paper, so I wasn't really writing. I don't feel like writing right now, so I've got to do something else. It's like when I was very, very early on starting out, when I lived in San Francisco, I did some work for a woman who is a great freelance film costumer. And I spent a lot of time in her office. It was one of the very early thing where she was sharing office space with a bunch of people. And I said, how often are you here? She said, I'm here every day. I said, what if you don't have something to do? She said, I always have something to do. I always play office. She said, I can always find something to do. I alphabetize my files because I haven't done that in a while. I write letters to people I haven't talked to in a while. That is my job. And that is what I do. So if you're looking to be a writer, it's your job. And what you're talking about is I need, you know, carving out the time to do it. But if you make that thing because you're dedicated to it, it'll happen.
We're back to Robert's definition of a hobby. Oh. It got very serious. This is how you are a writer. Michael's like, I'm just trying to pursue my interests.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I have a writing job. I'm good.
I have taught writing for a really, really long time, and it's one of the things that comes up a lot is going, oh, but you know, I just can't find the motivation to write. And it's like motivation, it's discipline, discipline, mm-hmm. discipline.
Well, and one of my teachers talked about, like, you know, how comparison doesn't work because you can't just like start right off where the people you're probably admiring are at. And then a metaphor of hers I really liked was, well, maybe now I'm mixing up like motivation and momentum, but just this image of a fire of like, you know, you got to start with like your kindling and your little twigs. Like you're not just going to like, bam, bonfire, unless you do something weird with like gasoline and don't ruin the metaphor. But the whole point is like you feed it, it slowly gets bigger. If you've been doing the thing, you know, every day as in like feeding your fire, like the motivation comes a lot easier. But then, you know, you go on vacation or it gets put on the back burner, your fire is smaller, you're not going to like jump right into the same bonfire of motivation with that project. You got to figure, you got to put your kindling sticks back on, and maybe it'll be easier this time. But I don't know. I've really, the fire imagery has stuck with me, maybe because I built a lot of campfires.
It's the second time in this conversation that a fire has been important. What I used to say to Michael was talking about a fire earlier, weren't you, Michael?
Yeah, I used the same metaphor to, and I agree completely. I think it wasn't with so much depth, but again, it was a similar type
erudition.
Of.
Yeah, no, it wasn't.
But I actually absolutely agree with you. It is easier to get into like sort of that state of flow when you are doing it on a more regular basis. It's self-fulfilling. So one of the things for me, the big one is that I have actual scheduling life around the and finding time. And then that I'm actually beginning to think becomes an emotional barrier to me doing it. When I do find time, even if I'm given an 8-hour window, I'll kind of spend a lot of it not doing anything and kind of being like, oh, I don't normally have time to do this. What's the point? Only this. So maybe there is a part of it for me that's a block that's coming up for any sort of flow. And
is it kind of like someone already tells me what to do with these hours? I don't want to tell myself what to do with this time.
No, it's honestly just, I think, like you say, if you haven't done it in a while, it's hard to get. It's like I would use the description of putting oil on a bearing. If you just put the oil on it, it takes a while for the oil to go through the bearing and to actually start coating everything for it. So it doesn't run smooth in the first moment you put oil on it. It takes a couple of turns till the oil spreads into every other part and lubricates everything. And then it gets warmed up, heats everything, spreads out, and then it starts running. And so I think it's a lot more like that they're like kind of the barrier of not having done it for a while then blocks me trying to figure out where I am.
Yes. So, right. Starting a cold engine. So this is, speaking as someone who's taught writing, what you can do to start that engine going, because often I think the barrier that holds us back is that idea of like, oh, if I can't launch immediately into a brilliant line or paragraph or whatever, then I'm not really writing. What we need is the ability to just kind of go like, okay, how do I warm up? And so there are various exercises that one can go through. And I've developed, say, for playwriting, a whole lot of exercises where it's just like you take a kitchen timer, you give yourself 5 minutes, and this is your assignment. And what's great about that is because you know you only have 5 minutes, you're like, oh, fuck, go. I've got to get something on the page. And the point isn't whether it's good or bad. It's just that you did it. And there is and at the end of five – So for the exercises I do, it can be something like write a 5-minute monologue, write a 5-minute conversation, just go. And then you do it again. It's a lot like woodworking. There's a school of thought that basically every morning when you know, if you're a professional woodworker, every morning you go into the shop and the first thing you do is you do a so-called 5-minute dovetail. You know what a dovetail is? It's a joint that fits together a very particular way. And you cut it in 5 minutes. And some of them are good and some of them are bad. But the whole point is, it enables you to both say, wow, I used my tools, but then also, you know what? I did something and it wasn't that great and I'm moving on rather than, oh, it wasn't perfect. So there are various other exercises that can be adapted to that kind of thing. Like you have 5 minutes, go write a describe what you had for breakfast. List every bird you can think of. You can actually, and that's actually one of the things you can do in the time that you've set aside for writing. If you can't think of anything else to do, start writing a list of exercises that you can do in 5 minutes that would help you with your writing. You know, you have 5 minutes, describe a place you've never been before. Describe a kiss, talk about, what someone looks like, blah, 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 blah. You may find out that is the kind of that is a thing that unlocks something that gets you to where you want to go. You may write something and go, oh my God, I could use that. Or you just simply say, and I'm throwing it away because all it needed to do was limber me up. And if it hasn't gotten the, like you said, I love the metaphor of the bearing that needs grease. If it doesn't feel loose enough, you just do another one. And that's why I love having a list of them, because you literally can just go, and that one. You set the timer and you go. You do not give yourself time to think. You just do it. And it's amazing how quickly you can get into a flow state. because there's no editor involved telling you why, what's the point? You might as well just stop.
So that falls in very much in line with what Tango was saying about it being more of an emotional barrier and a blockage rather than an actual, like, because what you're doing is you're getting rid of the emotional barrier by just kind of forcing through it, like just getting going, and then you're moving now already, so it's not going to slow you down as much. That's interesting. I will look into consider trying some of these tactics.
Book for writers, I think, is one by Annie Lamott, L-A-M-O-T-T. She's written a number of novels, none of which I have liked. However, she's written some excellent stuff about how to write. And one of the best books she's written, I think, is called Bird by Bird. And it's full of a number of different devices and exercises and things about writing and the process of writing and things you can do. It's not as prescriptive as what I just said, because I don't think she's autistic, but it is full of some really good. Yeah, exactly. Oh, can I tell you this? Oh, God. So yesterday, Sue and I were at a get together. Someone who is very, very beloved in the theater community in Philadelphia died a couple of months ago. And she was a great person and a great friend to a lot of people. And so we had a kind of memorial barbecue yesterday, where people were getting drunk and having a great time because that's what she wanted. And I bumped into somebody who actually used to work for me at my company years and years ago. And she said, long story short, she said, you know, I did some searching on Google and your name and the podcast interview you did with this other podcast came up right away when I searched for Autism Diagnosis Philadelphia. I said, what? And she said, yes, because of you, I discovered I'm autistic.
I love that.
Fantastic.
I know. And I said, well, how do you feel? Well, first of all, of course, I welcomed her to the team and hugged her. And I said, you know, I'm so excited. And that's great. Which I think I've done that now 3 or 4 times. And it really unnerves people because, like, wait, you're supposed to feel sorry for me. I'm like, no, this is the best thing that could ever happen.
Have you seen the congratulations on the autism cakes?
What?
Have you seen the Google congratulations on the autism? People have started making cakes for diagnosis called congratulations on the autism.
Really? Yeah. Wow.
I want one.
I want one. Absolutely.
Exactly what I thought when I got it. Where's my cake?
Did you? And you didn't send it. I sent you a fucking computer and a microphone.
No.
You
didn't send me a cake. I sent it as an image because I obviously was not going to send a cake to Ireland to someone I know who is diagnosed with autism. I have not sent cake to anyone. The cake would be for me.
Does it come gluten-free? That's all I need to know.
Who knows?
Okay. No, anyway, I don't know why I had to tell you that story, because it came out of the freaking blue. And it's like, all right, I think there are more and more people slowly but surely who are going like, yeah, that might actually apply to me. So there we are.
I wouldn't say slowly. I would think it's a rapidly growing I'd say the pandemic has been all the people taking all that time off to actually stop and go, maybe some of the stuff that I like for autistic people, I'm beginning to think that the pandemic may have been like a great moment for many of them just to take the moment and go, there's something, like, take the time to actually feel it and go, there's something not right about the way I am in comparison to the way everyone expects me to be. Or even just for mental health in general, people taking the time out. Like, as I say myself, that's how I've had anxiety or a vague form of anxiety for years, I thought. Turns out, no, very much autism. I would never have found that out if I didn't take the time out to try and get help with anxiety, but obviously I was just misreading a lot of the things that were going on because I didn't know what autism was, really, to be honest. But for a lot of other people, I've heard there's a number of more podcasts out. I see a lot more blogs about it, people recently discovering, and a lot of them seem to have been just because they took that time during the pandemic to
what just happened? Did your cat run away?
No, it came in.
And oh, pretty kitty. I can't think anymore of what I'm saying.
He is so pretty.
But you know, we've talked about this before. I don't know if we talked about it with Tango, but I think that is a very common autistic thing, which is to spend a lot of time thinking about how you're thinking.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So, like, so going along in absolute agreement with the whole COVID thing, Michael, it's like, and then what happened, of course, is because people weren't actually being pulled away from their thoughts, they spent so much time thinking about thinking that it's like, oh, maybe this is the idea. So,
and they had a few minutes to go and do some research or to ask for help or
research by which we mean Google.
Whatever it is, whatever it takes to find out what you need to know. Mine was calling a psychiatrist.
I don't know the actual number, but for every so many people who learn they're autistic, a few of them are going to go on to create content talking about it. So then, you know, the next day there's, you know, every person who's curious, might I be autistic? There's more and more content of people giving examples, because that was the big thing. For me, it wasn't just like descriptions of what autism is that didn't really I was curious, but I wasn't sure. It was when I started reading, especially women, like blogs of just like examples of just describing your life experience, you know, not giving me like clinical descriptions of your traits.
Absolutely.
Clinical descriptions.
No one emotionally connects to. You don't feel that that's me. Like, even when I was told I first had autism, I was like, I don't feel autistic. I don't feel like I connect. And then I was like, okay, it makes sense. There's some things that are a bit unusual about the way I do things and the way I think is a little unusual. But I was like, but what does it mean to be autistic? And then it was, again, meeting or listening to other people who are autistic, who humanize it and make it a much more realistic, much more relatable and realistic thing. And I think this is going to be, I think that moment of the pandemic, there was a lot of terrible things about it, but I think one of the silver linings will be for an awful lot of autistic people, there will finally be an explanation as to what's going on in their lives. Which is a fantastic, at least something fantastic came out of the COVID experience.
Yes, something. But I think...
And we got to stay home for ages without talking to
people. Without having to talk to other people.
Yeah, it was great.
Without having, and you know, maybe that's part of it too, is not having to spend a lot of time with a lot of different people. Because I find it exhausting to be around a lot of different people because it requires so many changes in masking types.
Yes.
Yeah. Where if you're just around one person a lot, then you kind of fall into a pattern and you only need to mask that one thing. But when you're on constant, self-surveillance to make sure you don't do the thing in front of a big group of people or this, you know, whatever. Maybe that's what actually led to a lot of people kind of going like, wait a minute, I feel more comfortable now because I don't have to pretend.
So maybe it was spending more time in their own personality rather than the personalized personality I give to every person I meet.
Well, I mean, there's been multiple times over the last few years, both living off grid and here in the city, where I'm, you know, mostly in my own home doing stuff. And I was like, I'm not disabled. I'm fine. I'm so functional. I'm the most functioning, you know, and then we would go to town or I go out to a restaurant or something and be like, oh no, I'm limited in certain areas in ways that other people are not. This is real. This is a real thing. And I'm going to stop gaslighting myself now. Sorry.
It is a very, it's funny the way you talked about it, Michael, of kind of like, you know, feeling whether you agreed with it or how it felt for you to accept autism and all. And I realized for me, there are times because now, like today was an example where I had to kind of go like, oh, this is what people mean by burnout. This is what people mean. This is what, various people have said to me like, oh yeah, when you are out of spoons. I was like, no, that's never happened to me. It happened to me today. And I was like,
Oh, this has actually happened before.
I was going to say it's definitely happened. What we're talking about.
Yeah.
Well, oh, yeah. But
when you're used to burning through your own, when you're used to pushing past your own boundaries, yeah, you stop noticing when you're running off glucose and when you're running off adrenaline.
Well, you just kind of go like, wait a minute. And also I felt like, maybe this way to describe it. I felt like now that I know it's an autistic thing, I felt like I could give myself permission to let it happen and not deny it and say, you know what? I need to take 10 minutes. You know what? I need to go outside. You know what? I can't be here right now. Where before
and I would just. That is functioning at its finest. That is truly functioning. When I have a problem, I address it. I do what I need to do to survive. That to me is the definition of functioning. When people say high functioning and low functioning is maybe just listening to yourself and adapting to what you are capable of. And what you're not capable of, and accepting those two things is truly what it is to be. I know we don't try not to use any more high functioning, but in the sense that, like, I've learned a lot to balance now. I no longer default to, or at least most of the time, I don't default to being in the wrong when I have an argument with anyone anymore. I used to always feel guilty and some sort of shame, like I did something wrong. But like, I was saying a while back, I had an argument and a fairly serious one with some family members, but I walked out of it going, well, I didn't do anything wrong there. And like, for once I could actually say 100%, I did not shout at anyone. I was not rude to anyone. They chose to get upset. And it was knowing I'm autistic makes that possible. Prior to this, there was always, I missed something. I was thinking about this
earlier, even on this call, because I am feeling a little tired, like lower spoons than usual on these calls. And I'm like, oh yeah, before I knew I was autistic, I would be like internally judging myself of why I'm not showing up better, which would then make me show up worse. And instead I've just told myself it's fine that you're a little low energy, like the conversation's going great and everyone will understand. Like, yeah. And so,
and you're allowed to be different energy levels at different times in your life. That's just fine. That's the mood I'm in right now.
To clarify, my functioning comment was a joke because no one has like a one eternal functioning label. Like, we all have our higher or lower, you know, days or moments or whatever. I definitely threw that in as a joke.
I was thinking about something you said about the other day about that whole high functioning and why it's not judgeable. Because you, and any given day, how you feel affects your ability to, like, how nervous you are, how certain things affect you, the people you're around, what your feelings are towards them, actually can set off all sorts of other things. And like, I never really realized that was true about myself. But every time I'm talking to people, I always take away, and I don't even realize I'm doing it. It'll be like 3 days later, I'll be thinking about something one of you said or whatever that we had during this conversation. And I'm like, oh, that does apply to me. Or there's an example of that that I didn't kind of fully get. And I may have argued with the person about how wrong they were at the time, but it's afterwards I'm like, oh no, I was wrong on that one. it's one of the benefits of talking about all this stuff that, like, you might go, it's the same thing over and over, but there's some small parts to it that you get off other people from their experience. And to me, that's the big advantage of talking to other people on the spectrum, that you're actually getting a more, less of a clinical definition of it, and more of just the thing that everyone always goes, oh, you know, like Monday mornings, everyone hates Monday mornings. And like, it's just, everyone assumes it's the same for everyone else. Mm-hmm. To get that feeling when someone says, do you do this? Or I had this happen to me, and you go, oh, that happens to me. That's normal. Oh, that's nice to know that there are other people who, I'm not just crazy, or...
Very cathartic, yeah.
Very, yes.
I've been thinking as we've been talking about this, about how I really have resisted for a long time accepting that autism is a disability, because I only ever think of it, as Mick Bolanski told me, as internalized ableism. You know, like, oh, a disability means, you know, you can't do what everybody else is doing. And then today I'm realizing, like, oh, there was actually great comfort in going, like, you know what? You can't do what everybody else is doing. Stop it. Just stop it. You have a disability.
You are a fish. Quit trying to climb that tree.
It doesn't mean you're not good at other things. It just means in this particular case, you can't handle this kind of craziness. And then I looked around at everybody kind of going like, yeah, this is totally normal. And I'm like, and I can't handle that. So that's okay. I'm happy. If that's what abled looks like, I'm very happy to be disabled. Yeah.
Well, I think about it in like the social model of disability, which kind of looks at disability, like relatively. So like a lot of the ways I'm disabled are like relative to how society is designed. Like if we shape things differently, I might not look disabled at all, or I might seem disabled in different circumstances. But so I think about it in like, it's called the social model, but I think I just think about it as like relative disability. I don't know. Like if we were like more weirdly independent or something and got in groups less often, like maybe the people who needed that kind of social attention, they would be more considered disabled.
We'd have to set up special places for them to go so they can have their little meetings and all hang out together.
Their needs met.
We did that. They're called pubs.
They're good.
What about the rest of them?
Any of the circumstances and make anyone's normal humanness look disabled depending on like the environment you put them in. That's how I attended. Maybe I
did have an argument with someone on Reddit about this, about whether autism was a disability or not. Or they were like saying, I hate the way that people won't recognize it as a disability. It is disabling. And I asked some questions about, and he was saying like sensory issues are a big issue. And I was like, oh, but are they actually necessarily autism? Are you saying there is such a thing as a sensory disability versus an autism disability? Because all my disabilities come from my sensory issues, not from my cognitive or so to say autism as a disability is a very complex thing, because are our sensory issues comorbid with autism or are they autism? Because for me, I have very few sensory issues. The few that I have, like you say, there's not a lot of velvet floating around, so I don't pass out a lot. So I'm not that disabled. But if the world was covered in velvet, if it was the 70s, I'd be in real trouble.
Where are you about velour? Can you handle velour?
I actually don't know what that is. It's a material.
Cheap velvet. It's very cheap velvet.
And most definitely not, because only the best for me.
Only the best pass out.
Only
texture.
The best.
Oh boy!
I want to get a full,
a full face plant. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is, as you said, Michael. I think it is a very important thing to have conversations with other autistic people to realize. You know, one hand. I spent a certain amount of my life going like, I'm fiercely independent and no one is like me and blah, 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 blah. And I realized that that was perhaps internalized ableism or the kind of thing of like, you know what? I'm going to turn that frown upside down.
It might have been protecting your own ego a bit.
Yeah. Otherwise it'd be just be like, you're just a freak of nature and you should be hunted down with, you know, torches and pitchforks.
You probably held both of those ideas.
Like on the secret island.
They often do.
The secret child hunting island that's run by Blue Apron. Oh no, wait, did I? That didn't happen, did it? It's a reference to a silly joke on another podcast. Don't worry about it.
And we'll have that other podcast in the notes, ladies and gentlemen. Do not worry.
Snail in a manuscript. Okay. Well, I don't know what we were talking about anymore.
I don't anymore either. I just...
All right. Well, will we call it then?
I think
we should introduce ourselves.
I hate this part. I'm Tango. I've known I was autistic for a hot minute. I'm somehow on the West Coast and I'm tired.
Pretty good. I like it. I'm Michael. I might also be autistic. We're not sure.
I'm Robert. No, I'm definitely autistic. So there we go.
Ta-da! Oh yeah, we're talking about, are we disabled? Because yeah, in my mind, I also don't, you know, younger me got way too neurotic about categories, like, you know, literal like definitions and categories, and like the world must be cut up into definitions and categories, and
like hobbies have to be very specific.
So I'm sure I haven't fully broken myself of that, but in ways I have made little alarm bells that go off. So when someone wants to get into the nitty gritty of like, is autism a disability or is it the sensory thing or the da da da, my little alarm bells kind of want me to like back out and ask a different, like, what's the other question, or what's the thing you really want to know, or what's the change you want in your life or in the world? Like, I feel like there are better questions sometimes.
And that was why I wound up in this argument with this person. It wasn't so much an argument. I just kept on asking him questions and then upvoting.
Sometimes people take that as an argument. It's unfortunate.
I think it did go that way eventually. But I was asking more questions that I have an answer to, but they were more rhetorical questions to think about. Like, is it sensory issues a disability in and of itself, or is autism, or are they the same thing, or what is the, what, like that thing we keep talking about, what is autism? There is no like different, and like I say, for me, very few sensory issues. They definitely are there, so I could say they are part of autism, but is it certain types of sensory issues?
I've known multiple audience who say the same thing, who are like confused about if they technically count because they don't seem to have the same sensory type stuff. And I'll talk with them long enough and learn more about how they think and whatnot. I'm like, oh, you're fam.
Like I was saying to someone about that, people say sensory issues. Well, the old expression chalk on or nails on a chalkboard, no effect on me. Doesn't bother me in the slightest. Almost everyone else in the world is like, oh my God, that's such a horrible, even the thought of it's really just sense. And I'm like, oh, you're having a sensory moment. You're having what we experience, a level of intense to a conceptual noise or the idea of it or the actual thing itself. The sensation of that is overwhelming you. And I don't have that sensory issue. So therefore, are you disabled at this moment or am I? Like,
Well, the last question's a good one. I like all humans have sensory processing and executive functioning. And usually what makes someone autistic is whether their sensory processing is hypo or hyper to the norm, you know, like that bell curve thing. And so a lot of what gets highlighted are hyper, I think, issues. You know, yep. I'm too sensitive to sound. I'm too sensitive to texture, stuff like that. And what you mentioned, nails on a chalkboard, don't bother you really at all. That sounds like hypo. You're like desensitized to certain.
Yeah, I don't really have many
certain noises. I don't know what vowel that is.
I have come to realize that I am hypo, and the thing I think that really drove that home, so to speak, was, you know, getting a full tattooed bodysuit where I didn't really didn't really bother me that much.
That's a perfect example.
Not to say I didn't feel it, but it was like, yeah, it wasn't that big a deal.
But you are aware it's happening as you're getting.
You're aware it's happening, but you're not like
and you process it as in that is painful.
Yes,
but not even
exactly.
Painful. That is definitely a distinct and it was feeling.
And it definitely was like, oh, that's happening to my body. It's not necessarily happening to me.
But and if it was happening randomly and I didn't consent to it, I'd probably move away like you do react to stimulus still.
Like, yes,
I'm not so lacking in sensitivity that I just don't notice my hands in the fire. Like,
okay, but I have to ask an important side question. Do you struggle to determine when you consider a sensation pain or not? I feel like I tend to get too specific and then I'm like, well, it's uncomfortable, but like, when does it count as like pain?
It's like the hospital scale. Is it a 1 to 10?
Scale doesn't make any.
On whose scale? On what? Like, this is, and then you're giving out to them about their scale, so they assume you're not in pain.
Right.
Because you're too busy giving out about the scale.
I often, when asked those questions, have to kind of go like, well, if I were someone else, this would probably be a 9. So I'm going to say 9 because it actually would be nice to have some pain relief. But I never know.
It's weird that you have to like semi-dissociate to.
I'm already disassociated, so I just have to go.
Yeah.
I just have to go like, oh, you need a number.
Absolutely, because, done that, Robert. Like, that's hilarious.
You know, when you go to a doctor and they say, "Oh, how long has this been going on?" and you have to kind of go like, "Oh,
time passes.
Maybe 7 weeks."
Well, and yeah, especially with chronic stuff, my doctor would be like, well, what is, you know, because I would complain about joint things and migraines and stuff. And he's like, well, what's discomfort? And like, what is actually in pain? I never understood how to answer that question.
Maybe the real answer was just given to us by Julie.
I would just think about how much of my attention it would take away. Like if I could kind of ignore it, then I like didn't consider it pain. Once I couldn't do my homework or something, like then I was like, oh, this must be pain.
But you know, when people ask you questions like, is it a stabbing pain? Is it an aching pain? Is it? And I'm like, I don't know what the fuck it is. It hurts. And Julie just pointed out to us that the pain scale that we're talking about was invented by Purdue Pharma.
That's the 1 to 10 scale with the faces. Like they have the distinct faces. Yep. That was, Purdue Pharma.
Yeah,
and they've just done such a wonderful thing for the world over on a wedge.
Well, I was going to say that I never know when I'm hungry. There are certain things like the unfortunate thing about working in a professional kitchen is you get burned a lot. And so very often I'll find out that, oh, I got burned after the fact. Somebody will say, what's that? And I'll be like, oh, that's a burn.
I get cuts on my hands all the time from that. I'll come home and I'll go to... I get cuts on my hands. I'll come home after work or whatever, and I'll have cuts on my hands that are bleeding. And I'm like, oh, there's a cut on my hand. Well, who knew? Oh,
Cuts don't hurt.
Well, that's the thing. To the point where you're not really even aware they're just slight enough that they're not really noticeable. Like, yeah. And then sometimes when you go to wash them, they're actually a little deeper than you think, but...
If it's a deep, clean cut, it actually, you've touched less nerve endings than like a scrape or like a jagged thing. So I had to look this up because I was like, how come I bump something or I scrape it and I feel it for an hour? Or if I, give myself a cut with a kitchen knife and I'm like, oop, nothing happened, but then I'm bleeding everywhere. And I Googled it. Because that clean cut is actually touching less nerve ends. You're getting less communication back. When you've scraped against all that skin, all of those little alarms are going off. Yeah,
whereas it's like you've severed the nerve in the other one. Like it's
it's a different alarm system.
I see what you mean.
Mm-hmm. Fun facts about
it. Fun facts.
I will remember that forever.
I thought it was very interesting when I was getting all the different tattoos that like, you know, when you get your butt cheek tattooed, you actually feel it in your leg in different ways. And then it would be weird because the needle would move like an eighth of an inch and all of a sudden you'd feel it up your back. And it all had to do with where the nerve, you know, where the nerves are running. It was bizarre. It's really bizarre.
That reminds me of
another. I know where you're gonna go. Okay.
Of another fun anatomy fact I learned literally just this morning, which is that we're updating from sort of a lever and pulley theory of the human muscles to a tensor system theory.
Okay.
So instead of just like one muscle or one group of muscles pulling on a bone, everything is kind of connected to everything else. Like this lady had a model where she's like, I can pull on anything and you can see it deforms the whole shape. The tattoo needle was going over like a particular piece of fascia or tendon and you were feeling like the pull on the other end.
Oh, it was very interesting because it's like, well, I wasn't expecting that feeling. Not there.
When I have a scorpion on my hand. And I thought like the bones of the back of my hand would really hurt, but it was fine. And there's like two little feet that wrap onto my palm. And these feet are so painful. Just that palm skin has way more nerve endings. It's wild.
Wow. Yeah. Huh. It was interesting. My bicep barely hurt at all, but other things like the back of the knee. But what really hurt was my stomach.
Ooh,
which I thought was really weird. And I figured it out. It's because the stomach itself did not really hurt, but every once in a while we kind of drift over into like lower rib territory, and then that was excruciating. And what I realized was I'd gotten used to the feeling of the stomach, which wasn't that bad. And then all of a sudden there would be this red hot, no, white hot, you know, pain. And just for a second, there was no way to get used to it. And there was no way to predict when it was. And that was what was, I've come to realize, like for a lot, like from our kids growing up and all, that a lot of the reason that a kid cries when they fall down is not because they're hurt. It's because they're surprised.
Yeah.
You know, and one of the worst things I've ever seen is when a kid, there was a kid on a swing set who fell off and did that thing of falling, and they just was like, the air was knocked out of them, and they were looking around like, what happens next? You know, that kind of like, oh, and nothing, you know, they were perfectly fine. But their mother sitting on the park bench next to us screamed, ran over, oh my, made such a big fuss. And that's when the kids started crying because they were scared of their mother's reaction. Mm-hmm. So then you start, oh, look at that. That's how that happens. Now we're going to start associating things like this with panic. And, you know, whatever.
I had to spend a lot of effort not to, when Felix is getting able to walk and stuff, when he falls over, to control myself not to react, just to let him stand up and go, you're okay, don't worry, keep going. And he'd go, oh, okay, I'm good, keep going, and just keep going. But if I was to go, and me and my wife would often joke about it, you gasp just a little bit too loud, one of us might go, and then he'd be like, and the tears would come. We're like, damn it, I gasped. I didn't mean to. If I hadn't, he wouldn't have cried because he's not actually hurt in any way, shape, or form. But when you are worried, he picks up on it, and you're doing most of his queuing up of his emotions for him. And you did it indirectly by just going, because then he's like, oh, that's bad. That's like a shocking sound. And you instantly get scared and run. And I was always amazed about how you have to actually kind of bite your lip and don't, even though your kids have fallen over and you don't want to, you want to run over and grab them, but maybe sometimes just bite your lip and go, it's okay, just get up, you're fine.
But don't you want to just more like shake them? Just be a man, for God's sake.
I will never say that to my son.
I'm sorry, it was a poor joke.
No, I know. It just amazes me. I was listening to another person talking about the concept of what, I keep hearing about this thing called toxic masculinity. But what is masculinity without the toxicity? Like, it's literally everything that we've been trained is masculine is basically toxic.
Yeah, pretty much.
And you're much better off thinking in terms of, say, instead of being like, man up and do this, it'd be like, how would a rational adult handle this? I like to call it rational adulting.
Rational man.
Yeah, I do feel like the descriptions I've seen of toxic masculinity is sort of like an immature boy's idea of what a mature man is, because he doesn't actually know yet.
But the thing is, a lot of what's pushed on us is like, there's masculinity is just toxic. There's very few definitions of what it is to be a man.
Well, and I think that goes back to what I was saying about how we don't have a very mature culture, that these immature behaviors have been really normalized.
The big tough man who tells everyone to shut up and gets all angry and goes all, or the stoic silent type who just walks off and has no emotions. And you're like, that's not us.
Which is just a 12-year-old in an adult's body.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's all terrible.
That's it. The world's over. Let's just stop.
I think the big, well, because I know that was a joke, but some people think that, and I have a response to, and I just think that we're able to change more than I find a lot of people think we're capable of as individuals, as communities, as society. I just think, yes, you can list all of the things that like suck right now. And then you're like, however, can we change it all? And I'm like, I actually, like, more than I was led to believe growing up, I've seen and made more changes in my life than I thought were possible. And now I'm like, I think more people just need to know how much they are actually able to change of their personalities, their behaviors, their, you know. What? It's yeah, and then there'll like be all these downstream effects. It's not as hard either as we think it's going to be. So I think a lot of it is like pessimism and lack of imagination, which maybe is just, you know, the fear-mongering news probably doesn't help people think about positive options for the future.
Oh, no. I mean, how can it? I mean, no, you can't. You can't.
You can't change.
I think that's why I curate my social media the way I do. I know y'all probably don't like scroll a bunch of social media, but like I am looking for people who are just like you do. Is that what you said?
I love death scrolling. I love reading the terrible news that is this world. Doom scrolling. Doom scrolling. That was the word I was
trying. I try to curate of like, yeah, people who are at least trying to think of like positive changes or just creative ideas, or I don't think it all has to be my doom scrolling. I can walk away from doom scrolling feeling good. And that's when I'm like, I have curated my feed correctly.
I might not have achieved that.
No, I realize you guys are both a lot more deliberate about what you do in life than I am. I just be like, oh, if only there were some way to change that.
There are just lots of baby steps.
You just said yourself, since getting diagnosed, you have changed the dynamic within your relationship. So you've given new information, you experimented with it, looked at it, and without even really any effort, just went, oh, I should do this thing now, or this is probably upsetting my partner, or your partner is able to change based on the information that you are now able to give them. So change, tiny little changes. But if everyone on the planet did that, it would be a huge fundamental shift. Like, so like Shitango's saying, the change isn't really that difficult. It's just once everyone starts doing it, the scale of
it
will
be surprised how it adds up, how it scales. Yeah.
But getting to that kind of, what's the word?
This is why I don't like when people like overly identify with their, what they call their like autism traits, because sometimes that might actually be like a trauma trait that you can totally transform into something else. You can heal it and turn it into something else. Like there probably is something cathartic about owning it and being like, well, I just do this, or I just can't do this thing the way people want me to. Like that's great, but then don't get stuck there. You actually can, like,
you could maybe find a different way altogether of doing it that fits both your needs and the social, functional, whatever it is that you also need to. It's like sometimes me and my son will say that, like, he'll be like shouting in the car or something, and he'll be like, but I need to. And I'm like, well, unfortunately, I also need you not to scream in my ears. So we have to figure out a way for this not to be affecting me or you. So maybe if you have some chewing gum and chew that instead of screaming, how would that work? And like, that works. Like, he's like, okay, that seems fair. And I definitely need him not to be screaming in my ears. And the other option is, if he doesn't want to chew the gum, I can always put it in my ears. So it's perfect.
Compromise.
We talk about a lot of things on 18 Podcasts, and sometimes it's hard to keep up, even for us. You can find links and more information about some of the topics we cover in your podcast provider's description of this episode. Thanks for listening.